Father, we come before you. We are creatures. We live in this universe. You handcrafted this. You designed this. There are things built into this, things that we need to know about. There are the way things work and the way we can work within that context. Or sometimes we get in disharmony with those, and sometimes we create scenarios for ourselves, or people impose scenarios upon us that we need your help from. We need your insight. Sometimes we need your intervention. And as we look into your word today, and we look at this theological concept called redemption, we pray that we would see through it to your heart that beats, passionate love for your creatures, your well-wishing for us, your good-heartedness, your aggressive kindness, that we could tear away the stereotypes we have of you and that we have of your Son, and that we could see a little more clearly this morning your love, the respect that you have, the awesomeness of your forgiveness for us, and the work that you did for us. So open our hearts and help us be teachable and pay attention to what your word had to say. Bless us for your Son's sake, that we might honor him more. Amen. Now, we have been studying for quite some time what happened approximately 2,000 years ago outside the city of Jerusalem. There was an event that was recorded in the Roman archives about an execution. There were, 10,000 Jewish people crucified, plus or minus 50 years of that. We only know the names of two. But one of them, everybody knows, basically, his name. And there was something particularly odd about that event. And historians look at that event, and it's one of the things that they're most confident actually occurred in history, was the death of Jesus Christ. They're not sure exactly what all the reasons, and the historians and sociologists look at the different reasons and the political historians look at what was going on at the time. And you can look at these and you can look at it from that standpoint. And you can give explanations. And then when you run across this strange book, The Owner's Guide to Life, you get somebody else's perspective on what happened that day, what that was all about, why that occurred, the circumstances that led up to that. It wasn't that Jesus of Nazareth got plopped into this thing, but there were events that started back thousands and thousands of years ago that moved in this direction. This was architected according to what they call the foreknowledge of God. Somehow, some force, some love, some commitment, something on the part of God saw to it that this thing happened. That somehow, that this consummating act of love on the part of God for his creation occurred. It was a willing son that went, and the implications are what we've been studying for a year or two in here, and we'll continue on. And we've been looking at, trying to pay attention to what this says about how God understood that. And we were looking at words that everybody knew about 50 years ago, redemption, sanctification, salvation, justification, propitiation, all the Asian words. And the one we're on now is redemption. And we covered sacrifice last year, and if you remember, the basic notion of sacrifice was it was something that cost something. It basically cost something. When you had a breach of a relationship and it needed repair, a good relationship, or you needed to strengthen that relationship, you took a step in that direction. And that commitment was expressed as some kind of economic value, sheep or vegetable products, or something that cost you something, as a statement, I'm going to invest in this relationship. And that was what the underlying notion of sacrifice was, is that there was an element of cost. We discovered that was in the Old Testament, and God surprised us when we came to the New Testament, in that after he took thousands of years to convince us how big the cost actually was and how bad the scenario actually was, so that it got way out of our financial reach to breach the gap with God, he said, surprise, surprise, I'm going to pay the cost. So I give my son for you as a sacrifice. So the cost was certainly no less diminished, but it was borne by another. It was borne by another, and we got to go free. And in the one that we're studying now, redemption, in those passages that we see over and over and over where it says God redeemed them, it was perfectly legitimate for him to have used a milder word and said he rescued them. Remember, we looked at the difference and we talked about how it looks like a rescue, but he uses the redemption word because what was the thing that was part, what was the core meaning of redemption so far? It involved the payment of a price, payment of a cost. Whether that cost was a substitute animal in the case of trading out animals, whether it was money in the case of redeeming a firstborn son or a broke brother-in-law, whether it was effort or commitment or activity on the part of a kinsman to go in there and be strong, either in military combat to rescue Lot from his captors or to go stand up in court and defend the rights of the fatherless, the widows, and the aliens. Whether it was any of those that always involved this cost element associated with it. And what we are at now is we're trying to look at a number of biblical cases so that we get this clear how this worked. That every case, remember we had this, you should have that little handout that's called The Factors of Old Testament Redemption, right? And so this was, remember, our mild and degenerating audience participation that we've been doing. It's now gotten into where everybody shouts out. It's no big deal. But it's working. It's working. So we're not going to mess with it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? And in each case, we're answering the question, and we've got a couple more to do today, about from what state was the subject redeemed and what was bad about that state. Remember, one of the cases was when Glenda wasn't doing well and he had to sell himself into indentured servitude. And so the state is I had to move away from home and live in a strange place with people I don't have relationships with, don't know, and I just take orders. And they provide food, food and shelter for me and protection and things of this type. So it wasn't all bad, but it's just I'm not at home. You know, it's not, I'm not in my own place. I'm not sitting under my own fig tree and my own vineyard. The model of ideal life for the Israelite. And so in that particular case, the state was indentured servitude, involuntary servitude. Okay, how did I get in? Number two was how did they get into that state? In this case, it was generally I sold myself into that because I messed up some other part of my life, got in trouble, and had to go do something I didn't want to do in the process. And there were other cases, remember, where I was actually captured by a military force and put into slavery, more real, something closer to real slavery. The third was from whom authority or domination were they redeemed? When somebody redeemed me out of that, who had the authority? The person that rented me for 6-7 years, basically, my master. Okay, remember, in the Old Testament, they were forbidden to do absolute slavery. You only got them for 6 years, basically. Okay, so that max. And then you got to go free, and then you had to have a party for them when they left, and you had to give them out of your own flocks. And so that's why some people wouldn't even go do that, because if they didn't have enough flocks, because they knew they were going to have to be good to them on the way out the door. They couldn't send them out empty-handed, according to God. God wasn't going to let that happen. And so in that case, the authority would be the master that I sold to gave the money to. What was invested by the Redeemer, in the case of my brother, Bill, or Chris, either one of them, if they had gone in there and done that, the cost of them would have been my labor wages for the rest of that contract period. They basically bought me out for the other 6 years of whatever it was I was working for, what my wages were. Okay, and then the resulting state in which I was redeemed unto or for, in that case, I got to go home. I could sit down in that big green easy chair, and I could relax and not be on call all the time. I got to rest, and I got to be around people that loved me and affirmed me and cared for me, and that I could tease and them not be offended by that, and things of that type. Okay, and so that's the basic structure of redemption in the Old Testament. And we're going through a number of biblical examples to where we always think in this term so that when you run across the word redemption in the Old Testament. You trigger, and you won't, even if you're at your desk at the office, if you run across it, you'll start saying, "How'd they get into that thing?" You'll shout it out, like you do in here, if we do enough habit-forming participation. Now, you'll have to watch that. Just be careful about that. All righty, so we are now, given that, and the way we're looking at this, one more comment before we get into that. On that sheet, under three, the type of adversary. Again, a little bit background here. Sacrifice had to do with good relationships that needed repair or needed strengthening, right? So we had, if I did an act against God, who was a community member, he's seen as a community member. If I violated some trust with him, I would have to make that good, or I could strengthen that relationship by just giving a special gift to him. A burnt offering, it was called, a statement of consecration, a statement of trust, actually, when I would give a major part of my life savings in that burnt offering kind of thing. And when I violated some community member, when I did something unethical within the community and hurt someone, did some kind of act of violence, either economically or emotionally or something of this type, I would try to make it good. I would try to go repair that relationship. Redemption had to do with abusive relationships and unhealthy relationships and abnormal relationships that were not good. Redemption is about getting us out of bad things and putting us into good things. Okay, so there's a huge different focus here. And as we go through each one of the different words that God uses to describe what his son did, we'll see different aspects, like sacrifice had to do with good relations, and redemption had to do with bad relations. Reconciliation has to do with repair of completely broken relations. We'll go through a number of these because God is in the relations business. God is at fundamentally, it's one of the strange things about the Christian faith, is that we believe in a triune God. We believe that somehow, some way, nobody knows how, and if they pretend to, they don't know. God is three persons in one essence. We don't know how that happens. But he is fundamentally already in relationship. The bottom line, the backdrop that he's trying to move all of us to is one gigantic trinity. People loving one another, united in spirit and love, but still different. Still different. Still three different people. Still a whole bunch of different people. God will do abnormal things to get us to depend upon one another and love one another and be forced to deal with one another. He will do strange things. He will bring all kinds of things into our lives to force us to ask for help, to force us to ask for prayer, for us just to need somebody to unload onto, etc. So he will do lots and lots of things. Most of the miracles he does are through people. Most of the stuff, just because he wants people involved in the process to build these relationships. So that you'll see this over and over as we go through. And in that three, the kinds of abusive things we were talking about getting out from under was oppression and capture. Remember, one of the ways I could get in that situation was a marauding army could capture me and take me off into slavery. The consequence engine was where nobody did this to me. I did this myself to me. This was was the old cause and effect. I was the cause, and my bad situation was the effect. This is where it was a legitimate consequence of my action. I got in trouble, and there's where the fruit is. Okay, the consequence engine. There's always consequences for our actions. Voluntary slavery was where I messed up this situation of my life, and so I sold myself into another situation. So that was voluntary. It was still my doing. It was my doing when I started. But I got in a situation where I couldn't. Okay, Proverbs has got this great verse that applies to students and applies to people that work in binge mode. That it says, "He that is slow to work shall be put to forced march." Okay, in other words, that night before, it's due the next day. If you've been slowing it up, you're now what's called a forced march. Bayonets at your back. We're going to go double time overnight, forced march, okay? There's no letting up on the forced march kind of month. And so this is voluntary. I got myself into this scenario. For example, I'll be working this afternoon. All right, I'm working on something. Four, an alienation from homeland and people. This is a essential issue that we face increasingly in today's world that this sense of isolation in our lives, this sense of alienation, it's amazing. I was reviewing a bunch of technology stuff, and we're on wireless and cell phones and beepers and all this kinds of stuff. And I remember somebody had said something to the effect that we have billions of ways to communicate, but nobody that will listen. But nobody that will listen, you know. And to the real things, you know. And so there's this sense of alienation. Where do we belong? Where do we belong in the universe? We've talked about this before, that this is God's playground. And that the person that's related to God as a father and as a member of his community belongs here. This is home. And this isn't the full home, because it's a little bit strange. We're at home in the universe, but not in the world, is what the Bible calls it. There's this system of malignant intelligences of which we pop in and out of, sort of, and in our behavior at least, that militates against God and tries to convince most of us that God is not good for some reason. And but we belong in God's presence, and God's presence is everywhere. His presence is everywhere. So those are the kinds of abusive relations of which we're looking at, trying to find in each one of these passages on page 8 what we're trying to be rescued from or to, or things of this type. And I think we're on number 9. And what I've been doing is I typed up all the larger quotes, so you don't have to just fly by, you know, blind with just this quote taken out of isolation. So 9 I'm going to read is from Psalm, and I'm going to read the larger context of Psalm that you don't have there. So the psalmist says, "Hear this, all you peoples. Listen, all you who live in this world, both low and high, rich and poor alike. My mouth will speak words of wisdom. The utterance from my heart will give understanding. I will turn my ear to a proverb. With a harp I will expound my riddle. Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches? No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is never enough that he should live on forever and not see decay. For all can see that wise men die, the foolish and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. This is the fate of those who trust in themselves and of their followers who approve their sayings. Like sheep, they are destined for the grave, and death will feed on them. The upright will rule over them in the morning. Their forms will decay in the grave, far from the princely mansions. But God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself." Now, what you've got is the psalmist that's under some kind of attack from apparently the power elite. When evil days come, wicked deceivers, those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches. So these are people who have the money and the means in ancient Israel to make things happen. In the case of the life of David, these would be the elders of Israel, the power people within Jerusalem that have money that could buy political support and go assassinate the king. This was a very, very real thing. In my quiet times in the morning, I'm in that horrible place of 2 Kings, where in the northern kingdom, every king is being conspired and assassinated by his closest associates. I have even, it's such a conspiracy thing, I have turned my chair around, so I have my chair now to the wall, so nobody sneaks up on me while I'm having a devotion. It's almost that bad because remember, this is one of the things that moral failure does, is that it's treacherous. It teaches us treachery. It encourages treachery on our part, but it encourages us to believe that others are after us too, because it's, remember, trying to rip apart all the relationships that God's trying to build. And so disloyalty and doubt and paranoia and things of this type. And so here are these power people that are boasting in their great riches. They say, "Look, I got everything I need here. I don't need anything." The psalmist says, "No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. A ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough that he should live on forever and not see decay." This point's pretty clear. You can't buy your way out of death. You can't buy your way out of death. It doesn't matter. Cryogenic freezing or not, you can't buy your way out of death. Okay? Okay? That he should live on forever, not see decay. Because everybody can see that the wise die, the foolish, the senseless, they all die. And that's the fate of those who trust in themselves. Key word, trust in themselves. And of their followers who prove what they say for some reason. Their followers see that they die just like everybody else does, and they don't get up, and they can't buy their way out. But they say, those were some great slogans. I'll write those down. That's a great way to, you know, something's not following there. And then he talks about, as we get closer to our verse, like sheep, they are destined for the grave, and death will feed on them. Now, this is an ancient Near Eastern picture of the shepherd, right, that shepherds the flock, right? Death is their shepherd, and they are destined for the grave, so that they are moving from one pasture to the next, and death is the shepherd, and is taking them along and fatten them up for the slaughter, although that's not stated here. But he's moving them for this. Now, you have to recognize that this is not your normal shepherd, because did shepherds eat the flock? No. Over and over and over, we've looked at this in the ancient Near East, that you almost never ate any meat. If you had anything other than grain, it was typically fish or oil. You didn't eat your source of income and food. It takes 1.5 kilograms of lamb's wool to clothe an individual per year in the ancient Near East, which means a small family would have to have a flock of 10 to 15 sheep all the time to keep clothes on their kids and themselves. And so you certainly didn't do it before the winter that you killed any of your sheep. But here death is pictured as a shepherd that's going to do the opposite. See, the only people that ate meat in those days were the rich folk. The rich folk, see, because they had plenty to spare, and so they ate not high on the hog, I guess, but wrong country. Okay, they ate high on the sheep. They ate high on the sheep. Okay, Freudian slip there. Okay, Freud, Moses and monotheism. There we go. Okay, it all comes back around. And so death is this shepherd that's going to take them here, and their forms will decay in the grave far from their princely mansions. In other words, when they go to be buried in the standard burial plots, there's not going to be anything beautiful like their princely mansions that they've got ornate. Okay? Their end will be like everyone else's. And then the psalmist says, somehow, but God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself. See? Somebody gets it. Somebody's got the bigger picture here that says, okay, should I think in terms of 70 years or 80 years or 100 years or 120 years, or should I think the big picture? Because that is but like that in eternity. You know, you always have to look at the standpoint of, you know, the big picture is longer than a lifetime. And the psalmist here has somehow seen this, and says, well, he said he's loyal to me, and they don't have the theology to do this yet, so they can't get all the way there yet. He's loyal to me, and his loving kindness is going to last forever, but I'm going to die within 120 years, likely. Okay? So how is his loving kindness going to last forever and ever and ever if he doesn't somehow keep me in some shape, form, or fashion in existence as a person? He's either going to have to resurrect me or do something weird in the grave, because I'm going to end up differently than those who spurned his love. So the psalmist, they didn't have enough data back then to get all the way to a resurrection body and the resurrection, until you get to Daniel. Daniel's the first time you've got some really big, heavy, those that sleep in the dust shall arise. Crystal clear, and you're already at the New Testament clarity levels. Right? But back here, they don't know. They're not sure. When you ask them, if you ask at the psalmist time, will you rise again? They'll say, of course, when God resurrects the nation. See, they would always think in terms of the group as opposed to the individual. God was going to redeem Israel. See? They don't get individualistic in it until we get a little further along. So God's growing their theology just like he has to grow ours, you know, in the Old Testament. But here, logic says, that, you know, they say, but God somehow... They're going to end up there. But somehow I'm not. God's going to redeem me from that power of grave that just feeds When it says their forms are going to decay, but somehow my form is not going to decay because God's going to redeem me. God's going to redeem me. Okay, so now your turn. From what state was the subject redeemed? Death. Okay? Now let's get one more level of precision, because was the subject going to probably die? Yes. So how much, when we say death, we mean eternal death or something. We've got to put a little bit stronger on it, right? The dead buried the dead. That's absolutely true. Yeah, but this is a little different. This is where I'm in the grave and I can't get out. In other words, death has got its power on me. See? And death doesn't get the final word here. Okay, so that's the state. And what was bad about that state? It is quite permanent. And it's degenerative. Right? It's degenerative because the forms decay in the grave, right? Okay. Now, how did they get into that state? Now, how would the wicked in this particular case get into that state? By a series of choices. Now, everybody dies, right? But how do you get into the situation where you're captive forever to death and death feeds on you? It's the choice. It's rejection, right? It's rejection of the covenant. In other words, when somebody has enough power, like the wicked here, when they have enough power to have enough leisure to sit with the prophets and listen to the prophets teach the word, and this is what they did. For example, in Ezekiel, you know, you'd go in there and they would go and they would sit around Ezekiel and listen to Ezekiel, and God would speak to Ezekiel. He says, you know, they're just coming to you for entertainment. You're just breaking their boredom. They're not listening at all. They probably giggled in the back about this crazy prophet, right? So they had the opportunities for advanced learning, which meant the scripture, basically. That's what you had to work with, okay? And so these were the people most confronted with the claims of Yahweh, the claims of God to be good to one another, to love one another, to take care of the poor and oppressed, and don't go pick on the psalmist, for example. Don't go try to steal the inheritance of the widow. Don't go into court and try to play technical games and get their land and their goods. These were the people that we would call in today's world, they had more light. They had more revelation, okay? And they were do-badders, actually. These were people where the rich here are the ones that are oppressing the poor psalmist, right? They're the ones. And so they got into that situation by rejection of God's law, rejection of God, the whole basis for the community, love, all the principles that they escaped from in Egypt, oppression by the ruling class and the powerful. They perpetrated the same thing. They replicated the same thing. Okay, from whose authority or domination would the psalmist have been redeemed? Death. Death. Now, in the Old Testament, see, you don't have much, you don't have a highly developed view of the supernatural evil powers in the Old Testament. You very rarely have any kind of demonic overtures. You start getting those late, like in Daniel. See? And the numbering, the census of David in 1 Kings, they're not aware that Satan's involved somehow. They're looking at it just from the standpoint of the way it looked in history. By the time you get to 2 Chronicles, and boy, they start seeing the big picture more. They know that there's now this agency called Satan, an adversary that's against Israel. See, but you don't have that. When here, it's just death that's feeding on them. Death is the oppressor. And we understand that to be more related also to evil influences. In this. Now, which type of adversary is it? Oppression and capture? The consequence engine? Voluntary or alienation? Now, this is of the redeemed person. Okay, so this is the psalmist, right, that was going to get killed by these rich people, let's say, in this case. Okay, and so how did the psalmist get into this thing? Number one, oppression and capture. The people that answered number two in the consequence engine were answering it for the wicked. Absolutely. So you're right there. And if any of you thought to say four but didn't, you're wrong. Okay. Not quite that bad. Strictly, let me rebuke myself here. That's not correct either. One of the main problems with death for the ancient Israelite was that it took them out of the community of the faithful. So there was that element of alienation from the homeland. So four is still correct, and I stand correct. Because that was a very real. Because when the psalmist says, psalmist elsewhere gets into this thing about, don't let me die, because how am I going to praise you in the grave? Nobody gives thanks down there. In the dark land of darkness, who sings your deliverance praises if I'm down there in the grave, right? And for the psalmist, what he's talking about is in the community of the faithful. In other words, everything was right there in the, around the temple, and the worship is where you proclaim the redemption of the Lord. It didn't do living Israel any good if I proclaim the glories of the Lord while I'm in the coffin. Nobody heard me. Soundproof coffins back then, too. We don't have this issue, right? But he says, you know, nobody sings your praises in the grave. That they the redeemed do. But it's not heard by anybody up here. Let's put it this way. And the psalmist says that in a couple of different places. And that's where the psalmist says, hey, I'm not going to do any good for you, God. You know, if you don't, you know, save me here and redeem me. Because I want to go in with songs of thanksgiving and deliverance. And let your people know to hang in there. To trust God through the difficulties that we face. Okay? 4, what was invested by the Redeemer? Do we have any data on that here? In this verse, probably not. But you can see on the other one about the wicked, you know, where it said, who can give a ransom for his life? Who can, you know, a person's human life is too costly. There's not enough money that they could buy death off with, right? So there's still that element of ransom, but it's just beyond reach. The cost would be beyond reach. And the implication later, we'll see, of course, that the cost that God paid to get us out of that scenario was pretty expensive, to say the least. But that we won't get that till we get to the New Testament, which is in a couple of weeks. Okay. 5, what was the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed unto or for? Right. Received by God. And because it was very clear. And received by God was that acceptance thing. And for the Israelite, what received by God meant had a very concrete application to a visualization for the ancient Israelite. Because received by God meant that they went into the temple. They got inside the tabernacle, or they got close to the epicenter of God in their camp. And so the psalmist is always saying, oh, you know, when shall I appear before the Lord? And when can I go? Because inside the temple was safety. When Israel was walking before the Lord, the temple was the safest place to be if you were in a right relationship with God. If you were in a wrong relationship with God, it was the most dangerous place you could be. That's a separate issue, right? But if you were dependent upon God and you knew God and you had a relationship with God, that was the safest place to be, was inside there. It was quiet. The psalmist would go in, King David would go sit down in there, and he would think. He would have access, and he would sit down. And there's a whole psalm written because one time he's sitting there and he looks up and there's this bird making its nest in the temple. And he reflects about how beautiful that is. And that's the way I want to be. I want to build my nest in the presence of God. I want to build, I want to be like that. And being received by God was like that. Warmed into the palace. Warmed in, said, come on in here. Food was always good at the king's table. Fellowship was always good. They always had fun there. It was a good, warm, and safe place generally to be in good situations. If you were David and Saul was king, it was not a particularly safe place. If there was a javelin sitting real next close to Saul. But apart from weaponry and things of this type, it could be a good place. But certainly with a God, God is king. So that was the resulting state. So that's 9. Let's go to another psalmist, 10, which is Psalm 55:18. Okay. And I'm going to read the larger passage, starting in verse 9. Confuse the wicked, O Lord. Confound their speech. For I see violence and strife in the city. Okay, so first of all, what are the wicked doing here? 2 things. Violence and strife. Okay, they're stirring up trouble, breaking unity, but they're also doing violence. It's not just, you know, they don't live according to my religious standards. This is not a judgment of ethical superiority on the part of the psalmist. We're talking violence. They normally don't complain about smaller things. They got bigger fish to fry in those days. Day and night they prowl about on its walls. Malice and abuse are within them. It's almost like the spirit of vandalism, where you have nothing to gain from the act that you do. It's just fun to hurt somebody, destroy things, That's the kind of malice that he's talking. Malice, they don't need this. They got money, they got wealth, they got power. They're just looking to hurt somebody to prove to themselves that they really are God, that they can be God. Destructive forces are at work in the city. Things are eating at us. Threats and lies never leave its streets. See, this is that paranoia thing I was talking about, destructive forces tearing apart the community. If an enemy were insulting me, I could endure it. If a foe were raising him against myself, I could hide from him. But it is you, a man like myself, my companion, my close friend, with whom I once enjoyed sweet fellowship as we walked with the throng at the house of God. You know who uses that in the New Testament, right? Jesus, about Judas. This is applied to Jesus and Judas in the New Testament, that he had had close fellowship and had worked in that ministry with Judas. And that was part of what the problem was. It wasn't a foe. It was betrayal. It was betrayal. Because he picked. Even though he knew, he still did the personal risk thing. He still took that step and entrusted himself to another. I once enjoyed sweet fellowship. Let death take my enemies by surprise, the psalmist continues. Let them go down alive to the grave, for evil finds lodging among them. In other words, evil has a place. It has a home in their lives. It's not like they just occasionally fall into sin. Not occasionally they just, I'm going to do something wrong today. No, evil lives there. It's part of their life, part of their lifestyle. They'll go make rounds of the city, prowling around like animals, right? This is major character disturbance we're talking about. Evil finds lodging among them, but I call to God, and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon, I cry out in distress, and He hears my voice. So if you had to pick a time to pray, when would you pick? Yes, all the time. Evening, morning, whenever it hurts, you pray, right? You distress, and He hears my voice. He ransoms me unharmed from the battle waged against me, even though many oppose me. Now remember, we've made a distinction here a couple of times that sometimes He redeems you after you're captured, and sometimes He redeems you from being captured. Depends on what lesson He's trying to teach you. Because there's all kinds of lessons and all kinds of things. And so in this particular case, He's ransoming me unharmed from the battle. We don't know where in the battle I get ransomed. I could be captured and be starting to be taken. But the battle is generally a process kind of description as opposed to an event. He ransoms me unharmed from the battle waged against me, even though many oppose me. I'm outnumbered greatly here, but the old, you know, one plus God, the majority, they probably had bumper stickers on the chariots back then. Okay, so, and a little thing here. From what state was the subject redeemed? Violence and strife, destructive forces, oppression, they were going to get, the psalmist was going to get maliced upon. Let's put it that way. Was going to get maliced upon. Okay? Don't know the form, and probably the evil people wouldn't have known either until they got there. What are we going to do to David? What are we going to do to Asaph? What are we going to do to the psalmist? Whatever. Okay? So the subject was redeemed from, and specifically it's described a battle. Right, so it's actually an engaged thing. I mean, it's a battle that's going to have confrontation with it and conflict and perhaps and the violence aspect. And what would have been bad about that state? It was just bad. I mean, there's a thing about oppression, but in this context, it's even larger than that because he's complaining about the effects that it's having on the city too. See, this is not just him; it's also his family, his friends, you know, the unity of the group. Back in those days, to stay alive, you had to stay together as a group. You had to defend yourself constantly against marauding bands that would come across the borders. You were always having to stay united. You couldn't be divisive. You couldn't fight and move outside the city walls and be stubborn, go sleep on the couch thing. You couldn't do that because the marauding band would come haul you away and sell you to Egypt, sell you to Arabia. So you had to work things out, you know, the way you stayed inside the walls. for the fortified cities, or at least you stayed within the protective circle of the people that would defend you and not sell you over, offer you as a hostage. Okay? And because these things happen, right? And so in this case, it was the bad part also had to do with destructiveness in the city, destruction of community. So how would the psalmist have gotten into that state? Actually, if they were just hanging out around in the streets or on the walls. If they were just taking a stroll on the walls and they ran across this group, this gang, this gaggle of people that approached them, right? Maybe we'd call them a pride of people. A pride of people that would come across them, that's all you had to be, was being in the wrong place at the wrong time. There was nothing wrong after dark being out on the gates, especially if you were perhaps a ruler of the city, see? Or if you were a position where you could actually write psalms. Generally speaking, you had some responsibilities to man the gates and walk around and inspect the city. You had some civic responsibility, which would also explain why they were a little concerned about destructive forces in the city, because they did perhaps have some kind of responsibility for that. From whose authority or domination were they redeemed? Yeah, in this case, it's a companion, see? In this case, it hurts a little differently. Now, these are the people that are prowling around, but these are now what we would call turncoats, or betrayal types. Because this was somebody that used to not prowl around the city, right? Used to, they went to Sunday school with us. Used to be they were in our social group. They'd come over for Monday night football, for those that have the football thing. Okay. And in this kind of scenario, something's changed and all of a sudden somebody swung out, somebody spun out in the other direction, and now it's not just an oppressor. You see, that's one level of emotional pain, but this is an ancient friend. And if you've ever been in a situation where you had a friend in a group that turned and started teasing you back in junior high and had support of all the group, you know exactly a small aspect of what this is like. Right. Of course, the violence, you're in, you know, physical danger and harm as well, but there's also that extra little knife that this was. You too, Brutus? E too, Brute? Okay, so what kind of authority and dominion would they have been redeemed from? It'd be... Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I'm not the audience. Wait a second. Which one of those? Right, oppression and capture is the big one. That's the big one here, is oppression and capture. And you've got an element of four in here. You've got an element of four in here because there's that alienation, because there's that personal friendship, that companionship thing where the betrayal has occurred. So that there's a slight element of that in there as well. So the redemption on the part of God, how would what would have been invested by the Redeemer? Do we have any data on that? Not sure we've got any data on that here. Ransoms me unharmed for the battle. Now, the normal way that this would have occurred would be just frustration of the act of violence. A lot of times the way God frustrates, you know, if you take any particular crime and you take the ratio of attempted X to actual X's, you know, the number is just hugely disparate. I mean, you got so many more attempts that get frustrated than actual occurrences of any given crime, especially violent crimes, that, you know, the system is built somehow to frustrate that. So it's those things that when you try to break into the house, if you don't get in the first 30 seconds or something, you know, you give up and you go away or whatever, you know, that kind of dynamic. So it could have just been some kind of providential weirdness, some timing thing on the part of God, all it would have cost would have been some kind of investment of that type. We don't have a lot of data, basically, in this particular passage about that. What was the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed unto or for? So if I'm walking around, here comes this group. They hassle me. I get up and I go free. I get out alive. What was my resulting state? Right. I'm just living. I'm back to where I was, sort of. But now I now have a new problem, by the way. I now have a new problem of bitterness. See, I've got some issues I've got to deal with because now I'm afraid. And I'm going to have to, it doesn't, in other words, there's still a consequence engine that works. You know, you run across a situation like that, there's some song about trusting one another. Why, you know, every time you start to do that, you find some crazy with an army or a knife. That's how the song goes. And so you you start saying, should I trust again? Should I reach out? How do you not completely close up in this? And so the psalmist he was so shocked by the companion thing. I could handle this. I could shut it down emotionally because it was just a foe. I could fight back, but how would I get my brother? Just tough to do. Let's see if we can get one more in here. Now, this is a historical one, number 11, Psalm 106:10. And I'm going to back up to four verses. The psalmist is talking about Israel's history. We have sinned even as our fathers did. We have done wrong and acted wickedly. When our fathers were in Egypt, they gave no thought to your miracles. They did not remember your many kindnesses, and they rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. If you remember Israel, Israel sits there and goes through the 10 plague thing. They get going, they march all the way to the Red Sea, and at the Red Sea, they're sandwiched in between drowning and death by Pharaoh's chariots that are just charging ahead. They're caught there, and they say, why did he bring us out here to kill us? There are no graves in Egypt. Well, actually, they do that on the other side, but that general, they complain, they murmur, they complain against the law. Even Moses wonders what's going on here. God has to tell him, sit down, shut up, Moses, be still, and see the glory of the Lord. Okay, just calm down. And they get up here, and they don't think about what's happened, the 10 plagues, right? Because logically you'd say, okay, I'm in a difficult spot. I was in a difficult spot. God did some heavy miracles. Why would he shift into standard ordinary mode right now and let me die because he ran out of miracles? And so they didn't even give any thought to that, to try to figure out logically, click. What's the consequence here? Yet, he saved them for his name's sake. They sit there and they'd given up on God. God said, not going to give up on you. I saved them for his name's sake to make his mighty power known. He rebuked the Red Sea and it dried up. He led them through the depths as through a desert. He saved them from the hand of the foe, from the enemy, hand of the enemy. He redeemed them. The waters covered their adversaries. Not one of them survived. Then they believed his promises and sang his praises for about another 3 weeks. We do this. You know this. We do this too. Tim.
Right.
Right. Right. That's right. You know, God is going to definitely get this message across. Absolutely. He's going to get this message across. When Israel gets out, by the time they get to the promised land, everybody in the land of Palestine knows about this event. The people in Jericho are already quaking. They've heard about it. The Philistines over in the five cities along the coast, they've heard about this. They argue among themselves, don't be like the stupid Egyptians that didn't let them go. They all know about this. Balaam is going to make this prophecy in Numbers 24 about a star shall come out of Jacob and rule the world kind of thing. We won't be able to get into it now, but I discovered this past week that the Roman historians around the time of Christ all knew of this prophecy and believed it to be true, that a ruler that was going to come out of Judah. It shows up in Tacitus and Suetonius and a couple other places where they were expecting a ruler of the world that was prophesied to come out of Judah. They understand that to be a Roman emperor that conquered Judah. So rationalizations work at any age. You could still make your own personal prophecies come true and blame it on the Bible if you want to, like the Christian community has been known to do. Absolutely. He got this message out. He used this. Actually, we'll have to finish this one next week. Because there's some other elements, there's some interesting stories about this passage that I'd like to get into next week as we go. But let me, in summary today, we've looked at just a couple of passages where you've got the word that God's trying to teach us, this fancy word redemption. He's trying to teach us that it has this element of rescue, but one with personal involvement in it, personal interest, personal investment, personal activity on the part of God. And for those... For those of us two-legged, hairless mammals, okay, basically, some of us are more hairless than others, obviously, We are all in that situation of needing some kinds of rescue, different kinds of rescue. And that is what this God was teaching Israel about this metaphor, trying to understand that he was the God that redeemed them. The personal, you know, this was both a personal issue. The psalmist was going, help. That's called personal redemption. Help. I'm in trouble. Please get involved quickly. And this passage that we're looking at here was where he redeemed the whole nation. We, on this side of the cross, still have individual redemption. We still have individual help, help, help. But we also need God to work in us as a group, as a community, to redeem us from destructive forces within our group as well. We always have to constantly work on love, constantly work on paying attention to one another, listening. There are elements that we need as well in corporate redemption as well as our individual redemption. But the good news is, like I say, this is something that the cost was borne by another. The cost for us on this side of the cross was pretty clear. The cost was nailed to a Roman execution cross some 2,000 years ago. So we wouldn't have to be. So we could go free from that kind of death. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your love. We thank you for your patience and persistence in trying to teach us these things. You've gotten so much of this stuff in your book here just to try to get us across to our thick heads that you love us and that you are the active agent in calling us to yourself. That this isn't some huge effort that we have to work up, but that this is a matter of letting our guard down and just relaxing in your love and trusting the only loyal, the only perfectly faithful lover in the world, you. The only non-treacherous, completely loyal person in the world. And we can only do this because you have told us that this is the way you are, and you have demonstrated this in the person of your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, and in many of our individual lives as well. We thank you for that redemption, that rescue at a price that you've done in our lives. I pray that this week we would reflect upon these things and we draw closer to you, that we would be received by you. We would go in there and we'd build our nest in your presence. And we would make that our home so we could relax in your love more and more. We ask this for your Son's sake because of what he did for us. Amen.